Ladies and gentlemen, yeah, I think we are going to start. Most of the chairs are filled up. I think the others will. We had acceptances from enough to make an overflow crowd. Some of them may have been psychic about the number of chairs in the room. But I am delighted to introduce our latest rock star, Dr. George Verghese, who's just finished up a rather long stint. What was it, 4 years, 5 years? The Asia Foundation's country representative in Kabul. I'm Tazi Schaefer. I'm director of the South Asia program here. I'm also a trustee of the Asia Foundation, so I'm hosting this meeting in kind of in both capacities. Afghanistan today is the largest program the Asia Foundation runs, and it is as good an example as you can get of the transformation that the foundation has undergone from an organization that did kind of exchanges between the United States and Asia to a development organization, which still does some of the other stuff. And George's program was at the lead in that. They have worked on institutional capacity building in central and local governments. They have worked on governance. They have continued to work on women's advancement and in supporting the political processes in a country which, back in Sam Lewis's day as ambassador there, and even well before that, has never had a strong central government. And was catapulted after many years of civil war and external intervention into a requirement for instant nation building that would have taxed the most competent and practiced masters of that art. George is about to go off, literally about to, the day after tomorrow, to be the Asia Foundation's country representative in Nepal. A country which 20 years ago we would have said would be a very different experience, but today I think it may be less different than we would all like. But where I'm sure his experience with governance and the development of political institutions from a very low base will serve him well. He's kindly agreed to talk to us today about central and local government in Nepal, and I'm sure he will tell us both about the state of play and about what the Asia Foundation has tried to do to support them. After George's remarks, we will hear... Sorry, in Afghanistan. The Nepal talk will come later.
Mind doing it. Two for one.
After his remarks, we will hear from Karin von Hippel, one of the co-directors of the CSIS Post-Conflict Resolution Program and the doer of much of the work that CSIS has done looking at Afghanistan. So without further ado, George, you have the non-existent mic.
Thank you. As always, I'm pleased to say a few words about my experiences in Afghanistan. I'm grateful to CSIS and Tezi for hosting this, simply because I fear that in another month or two I will be unable to coherently talk about Afghanistan, having fully immersed myself in Nepal. So it is really a privilege and an opportunity I value very much. Just to go over a little bit of my background, I first went to Afghanistan in August 2004, in the period leading up to the presidential election. And I moved my family there in summer of 2005, in the period leading up to the parliamentary elections. And we left there recently in March 2009. Our first daughter grew up in Afghanistan, and our second daughter was born recently, but was conceived in Afghanistan. So I don't claim to be an expert on Afghanistan. All I claim to bring to the table are some experiences with some of the important political processes that have gone on at the national level and a couple of processes that have been initiated at the subnational and local levels. The reason I mentioned 2004, 2005 was to quickly bring us to the flavor of the month in Washington, which is the forthcoming election in Afghanistan. And I thought I might situate my thoughts and maybe provoke the discussion around that because it's topical and because it has bearing, in my view, on both national and local governance. First, I think it's important to remind ourselves of who are the people's representatives in Afghanistan to date. We have the president, we have a bicameral parliament of which about two-thirds is elected, and we have representatives to each of the provinces, provincial councils. In a sense, that's all the elected representation that exists in Afghanistan. Municipal and district elections have not taken place, although they were stated. This is a critical flaw and a gap in governance in Afghanistan. Nor are district governors or municipal mayors elected. They continue to be appointed. The elections this fall will result in either a new president or the re-election of the incumbent president. The immediate following elections will return a bunch of elected representatives to parliament and provincial councils. But what does this mean for the post-election period? And this is something I've tried to focus on in the last couple of days while talking to colleagues and friends in the U.S. government and others outside of government, because I feel that we forget to focus a bit on what might be some of the performance metrics in the several months and perhaps the first couple of years of the next presidency in Afghanistan. And I think it's important to talk about that now, get past some of the event-based hype and perhaps extensive discussion. We can take it for granted that the elections will be the most expensive elections to date. That is part of the problem. But definitely not the most important part. Hopefully it'll be credible. I have no reason to believe that there will be significant obstruction by anti-government forces of the elections. But beyond that, I just want to quickly go into three or four points that I think we should pay attention to now so that we may drive some of the discourse now and following elections in the fall with regard to holding the new administration in Afghanistan somewhat responsible, along with the international community that supports the new administration responsible for immediate and perceptible progress in the first several months, such that the Afghan public feels moved to invest and continue to invest in what might be called a democratic experiment in Afghanistan. There is much made about much talk about corruption and the perception that the public have about corruption. Most of you have heard about our work, survey work on public perceptions over the years. I designed and led these surveys, and I'm pleased to say that we'll be doing it for another 3 years, including this year, for which we're very grateful to the U.S. government for actually investing in it. That survey has shown over the last 2 years that there has been a huge spike in public perception of corruption, not only at the national level, but more importantly at the local level. We measure that perception at the local level by asking people about their experience, direct experience with corruption. So this is really tangible and it's clear and it's present. And it has to do with corruption related to obtaining official documentation, corruption related to applying for jobs, etc., etc. So this is a problem. Therefore, in my view, an important performance metric for the new administration will be to demonstrate a perceptible shift towards the beginnings of the fight against corruption in Afghanistan. By that, I mean you cannot definitely eliminate it. At this stage, you could not demonstrate clear progress at the local level, but you could at least have some symbolic shifts and symbolic moves that could be taken with regard to cabinet formation, with regard to appointments at the senior levels of government both within Kabul and outside of Kabul. The rest involve a serious, expensive effort, public administration reform, and the development of non-state actors in holding government accountable vis-a-vis corruption. The second point that I think is important to focus on in the post-elections period and therefore discussion now is driving public discourse in the direction of key sectoral areas that have demonstrated success over the last several years. I think we get away sometimes from ourselves by getting into some idealistic discussions about what is achievable and what's not. And generally we think everything is achievable given the levels of investment and foreign aid given to Afghanistan. But the truth is that there are only four or five sectors that have shown clear progress. Health, education, rural reconstruction, and to some extent the energy sector. It is important to remember that these are the same sectors that the public relate to, that the public think the government is responsible for providing to them in the last several years, and therefore these are the most important in any strategic communication and any sort of understanding of what the public thinks in terms of government performance and success in the past and in the coming few years. Therefore, I think the discussion must center around with Afghanistan's government and its partners on adequate and increased resourcing of support to these ministries in terms of both their capacity, but also simply in terms of enlarging their programs. There are three or four other ministries where I think there should be emphasis and a lot of discussion simply because these represent the future of Afghanistan's democratic experiment and its move towards modernization. One is supporting continued reform in the Ministry of Finance simply because it is the ministry that is the gatekeeper to the largest amount of development spending in Afghanistan. I think they've made a lot of progress, but it's really insufficient. I think that we have found in all our work there that it can be a barrier to investment simply because of the sheer size of the funds that come in. The Ministry of Rural Development and Rehabilitation and Reconstruction has shown that it's possible to actually partner with the Ministry of Finance and negotiate a license to obtain donor funds and deploy them very quickly and in massive ways throughout the country, which is why people really like the Ministry of Rural Development and Reconstruction. So continued investment in the Ministry of Finance would be good and in very large and significant ways. Ministry of Foreign Affairs is underemphasized but very important in terms of situating Afghanistan in a coherent, articulate, and substantive fashion within the community of nations in South Asia, as well as in the Central Asian region. We find that the capacity there is quite inadequate, and we don't think that the international community is paying too much attention to that ministry. The third ministry that is our favorite ministry, and one that Jane here can attest to, is the Ministry of Women's Affairs, where she managed our project there and set it up. We feel that this is the only policy advocate for women's issues, women's advancement in Afghanistan. At this time, it is important to build its capacity, but also improve its links to Parliament, because it is a frequent casualty of discussions in Parliament every year around budget year. It is one of the weaker partners in Cabinet and therefore subject to attacks by the stronger partners in Cabinet. Our efforts in Afghanistan have focused on making sure that this ministry continues to remain viable, is sufficiently funded, and capable to work on the 46 to 48% of the population that represents women in Afghanistan. So in addition to these two, three areas, it is not necessarily for government to do, but definitely for the international community to focus on, is a going back to what we call the other essential actor in governance, which is the non-state actors in governance. So far, the investment in reconstruction or development in Afghanistan has really focused for good reason on strengthening the state and the formal structures in government, and I don't think there's anything wrong with continued investment in that area. But I think to some extent, the emphasis has shifted too much away from working with civil society and with those actors that form an essential partner and in many ways a positive constructive critic to state building efforts in Afghanistan. So I would urge us all to contribute to those kind of discussions and that kind of pressure so that in the next 4 years there is some evidence that Afghan, when you talk about Afghanizing or Afghanization of state building or of Afghanistan's development, it surely involves more than just the government. It involves the civil society of Afghanistan in various forms. Finally, I think an area that I think is critical to work and progress in Afghanistan following the elections is a continued and increased focus on subnational governance. In the last couple of years, there has been this shift to focusing on governance, strengthening the links between central government in Kabul and a provincial government in Afghanistan. Now, many argue that this was done with a view to bringing the incumbent president back to power this fall. I don't have a problem with that. What I have a problem with is a sole focus on that, because I think that the creation of what is called the Independent Directorate for Local Governance, I think, is a unique opportunity and a rare one for Afghanistan's partners to invest in what will surely become the lasting framework for governance in Afghanistan at some point. I think in many circles it's heresy to talk about decentralization or talking about federalization of Afghanistan. But simply as a political scientist and someone who's lived in other very physiographically varied and heterogeneous societies, I don't think we can get away from a discussion of the ability to raise funds and disperse them at the local level in somewhat autonomous fashion, to respect the unique identities of the various cultures and tribal societies that exist in Afghanistan, and to help bridge the gap that has increased perceptibly over the last couple of years, as evidenced by our surveys, between the people of Afghanistan and the national level political structure that's been put in place by the international community. This has ramifications for political stability. This has ramifications for peace building and for political coordination of development, security, and governance in Afghanistan. I'd be happy to talk about our efforts in this, Tezi, but I think I've said enough for now. And would this provoke discussions?
I'm sure it will provoke discussions. Let me first invite Karen to comment. And for those of you who are not familiar with her program, she and her colleague Rick Barton have developed an analytical approach to post-conflict and generally troubled mess type situations. That's a technical term.
Thank you.
That I think has been very useful in a lot of different places and that I assume will inform her comments and perhaps questions as well.
Great. Well, thanks, Tazi, and thanks, George, for a really interesting presentation. And I see there are many more experts in the room, so what I'd like to do is briefly discuss what the work we're doing and then maybe pose some questions to you to start the discussion. And then hopefully we'll hear from a lot of the other people here who know about a number of the important issues in Afghanistan. Our project, along with Ambassador Schaefer's project, we're about to launch a new project focusing on what does a regional approach mean. You know, in a sense, we're hoping to provide the convening and debating space that people in government don't have time to do. So, you know, we're hoping to keep all of you informed. If you're not on our mailing list, by the way, please let us know, and we host events as frequently as Ambassador Schaefer's office. But we're really looking at how to involve coalition partners in a more profound way than has been the case so far. You know, in a sense, following up on General McKiernan's point to the American military, don't own the fight, because we need all the help we can get right now. So we're looking at ways of including them in, you know, from the discussion of the strategy all the way through to the implementation. We're also focusing on what does a regional approach really mean in practice? How do you bring in Iran, India, Russia, China, some of the Gulf states in a more profound way? How do you keep them? How can they be a source of stability as opposed to being spoilers? And this is an area that Tazi's office will really be pushing as well. And then finally, for us, what's really critical is how do you make sure the Afghans and the Pakistanis are in the lead? And that's been a big challenge, I think, as most of us know who spent time out there. So that's what we'll be working on over the next year or so. What I found kind of interesting, even after Obama and Holbrooke have been pushing this new strategy along, is I still haven't found a lot of clarity about what we're doing there. Everyone has tried to manage the overall agenda. We're not building a Valhalla Jeffersonian democracy and trying to downsize our expectations, but we're still doing all of those same things we were doing before. So it looks like on the ground we're still trying to build some sort of democracy, and it isn't really clear to me how, if you define that down, what does it mean for all the people doing all this great work there? So that's still a little bit confusing for me, and I guess what I have, maybe three areas I would push George on to go further, given his vast experience in the country, and now you probably have a lot of great reflections that you're moving on to your next post. So you talked about the constraints of the Constitution and how even at the local level, so many officials are appointed. We're trying to build subnational governance. How can you do that when you don't have elected local officials? And what is the best way to push that through without, or will we just have some strange situation where you have a constitution that's very centralized and appointed ministers and governors, and as you said, mayors, with promoting local democracy? Is that possible, I guess? And what might be the best ways to push that forward for us to think about here? The second thing is that we now have the A-team out there. I think we have some of the best and the brightest that are involved here in Washington and out in the field, not only in the U.S. government, but also in many of our major partners. Most of our major partners have their own version of a Holbrooke. So there's all these special envoys from a number of countries, Japan, France, Italy, Norway, et cetera. So the A-team is out there. What should really be the priorities? So we don't continue to do 100 things and not very do 100 things not very well. What should we be focusing on? And one of the areas I wanted to ask you about, I know it's important to support the ministries that are doing good work right now, but justice to me seems to be a big gap. And this is an area that the Taliban seem to fill. And you often hear about this long lag in court cases and people having... at the local level, this enormous gap, and the Taliban do some sort of rough justice that people wait years to have their problems heard. There are informal and formal mechanisms to do this, but it seems to me that it's an opportunity for us to really try to figure out how to promote justice in a more profound way. At least we're not dealing with Hezbollah, which provides security services and justice to a degree. They just really provide justice. I don't think they're doing hospitals or clinics or any of the issues that you see with Hamas or Hezbollah and other parts of the world. Even in Somalia, we had these Islamic charities that were affiliated to this Shabab group were providing a lot of social services over the years. So given that the thing that they seem to be providing at the local level is justice, how can we take that back and push that further? And then finally, I guess if you could also talk a bit more about how do you promote the economy. I mean, long term, it's really going to be about building an economy that's sustainable in some way. So what would you recommend for private sector support? You know, maybe we need a lot of this to be driven by governments, but what ways or what would you recommend to promote regional trade, regional economic opportunities in Afghanistan? So I think I'll stop there. That's it.
Okay. Maybe I should become an envoy, too, and answer these three questions. I think an answer to the first two questions might be the same. How do you achieve governance without elected representatives at the local level? That's, in a sense, your question. At least now, and shouldn't there be a focus on justice and what exists now and what could be supported? And the reason I think the answer is linked is because there surely exist informal forms of decision-making, dispute resolution, etc., and many of you have studied and read about those. They certainly have problems with them. But I think they exist. They are relevant to the solution of local governance and of, let's say, justice at the local level. Just to go back to the formation of the Independent Directorate for Local Governance, it has set up what is called Shura at the local level in several provinces now as a pilot experiment to bring elders, community elders, tribal leaders, etc., who have been excluded from the formal political structure simply because the elections deprive them of their traditional role in the provincial council. So these shura are already proving to be quite useful in two or three aspects. One is in resolving disputes, apparently at least 20 disputes on average per shura member within the last 6 months, for example. But these are the typical disputes that occur at local level, land, some household, etc. The second function the shura have provided is to prevent attacks on community assets such as health clinics, schools, bridges by insurgents. I'm speaking of our study in Wardak province on this, and now in Uruzgan and a couple of other places. So there is some provision of local governance through these kind of bodies. And in other places, even if it's not set up by the government, there do exist prior forms of collective action. I think that going forward, there should be attention paid to encouraging some partnership between such forms of governance and, let's say, the district governor's office and the Ministry of Rural Development and Reconstruction's community development councils, which have so far proved to be very good at channeling project funds for reconstruction and to some extent done some dispute resolution and a couple of other local government functions. I think it's going to be loose, it's going to be messy for the foreseeable future, but certainly it can be enabled to continue and not stopped. I think there are some people who are concerned about turf, especially between IDLG and the Ministry of Rural Development and Reconstruction. You know, whose are the CDCs? Should they be local government or should they be project delivery mechanisms? And I think what happens is, in the end, those forums suffer because of that turf war at the central level. Some strong signals in terms of funding and just the discussions in Kabul would be useful. I think in the subnational governance policy that has recently been drafted and moved up to the cabinet for approval, there is acknowledgement and recognition of these forms, including the CDC. So that is surely one of the ways to go ahead. The rule of law and the justice sector work so far has been quite a disappointment. There are several courthouses that have been built, and there has been a lot of training that's been done. But other than that, in terms of making access to justice timely or of quality, I would not say that there's been much progress. But it's difficult to argue that there could have been more, simply because of the difficulties also of areas outside urban centers to project formal justice. Therefore, the argument also to find new ways to encourage informal alternate dispute resolution mechanisms. The third question was on economic growth and what could be done. Thinking of economic growth as an essential anchor for political stability. And I think this question is relevant for Nepal, and this is something we've been tossing about in Nepal as well. The issue with Afghanistan that we've been kind of talking about and inserting into local discourse there is that we should begin to think of asymmetric economic growth in Afghanistan. I think now everyone talks about it, but basically, you know, let's not get tied up through a paralysis of analysis on the relationship between Afghanistan and Pakistan as central to all economic growth in Afghanistan. It is certainly not true. There are roadheads, railheads, and other various infrastructure penetrating on the borders of Afghanistan from other surrounding states. It should be possible to think of an economic model that takes account of it, that looks at the constraints to trade and economic growth in those kind of areas that border other states besides Pakistan. I surely am not arguing against focusing on Pakistan and trade with it and through it to India, but that is certainly a different set of problems that are perhaps related but could be treated separately. I think research on this is very, very thin. It's unfortunate that that wasn't one of the areas of focus for ANDS during the years that it was functional. It is possible to do that. It's not too late. I do agree that this is important. Simply to deny space for insurgency creep as well towards the north, northwest, and northeast to a great extent, that is well advanced. As you know, the heartland provinces are now affected by the conflict. And it is possible that if you don't have some recourse to economic growth and opportunity, that you can see insurgency creeping to the north.
George, let me exercise the prerogative of the chair and ask the first question from a non-technically panelist. There are two subjects that did not figure in your presentation, which are not directly Asia Foundation responsibilities, but which a lot of people have argued are essential ingredients in the kind of restoration of governance and of you know, a decent level of government control of its territory that you have been very much involved in. And I wonder what your comment would be on where, on the importance of, number one, agriculture, number two, security, and specifically policing, as part of an overall approach that includes the things that you're concerned about.
It is, I think, unfortunate that there was not much attention or leadership given to the Ministry of Agriculture for the first 4 or 5 years of investment in Afghanistan post 2001. That has now changed with the appointment of Asif Rahimi as the Minister of Agriculture. Most of you have heard of him as the Deputy Minister in the Ministry of Rural Development and Reconstruction. We are very heartened by it. He's really driving a program now of reform. The Asia Foundation, as Desi just mentioned, is somewhat involved in this, helping them explore a central government approach, a systems-based approach to reforming the Ministry of Agriculture, less to do with the technical aspect of agriculture, but make it very quickly a performing ministry in terms of thinking about promoting agriculture. Here, I would caution us against worrying too much about export of, let's say, fruits and nuts, which has been dominating the discussion on economic growth that's driven through agriculture, simply because other countries have overtaken Afghanistan in terms of providing a lot of these services, perhaps except for pomegranates, which still continue to be somewhat salient in the South Asian market. So agriculture as simply providing for the basic needs of local communities and the people of Afghanistan, hedging against famines and very difficult winters that have occurred over the last several years, I think that has to be the key focus, and returning land and making it possible for people to begin to farm again. As you know, poppy never had this problem because they get inputs from the traffickers in terms of seeds, technical assistance, advice, and taking things to market. Some of those lessons could perhaps be learned and used. These are not new ones, but... So I agree. I think agriculture should be a focus, and it is. I didn't mention it in the sectors that I talked about earlier simply because I wanted to give examples of sectors where the people of Afghanistan have felt progress has taken place. And as I say, that kind of perception is very critical for support to the new administration. So definitely investment in agriculture will be important. In terms of police... it is now clear to everyone that there has been underinvestment in the Afghan National Police compared to the Afghan National Army, specifically in equipment, salary levels, and training. I rarely comment on, let's say, the technical aspects of security simply because I don't know anything on that. Common sense dictates that you can only throw so many bodies at a conflict. In my view, the roots of conflict in Afghanistan are socio-political. And therefore, any solution, and in fact, the strategy you mentioned, I fail to detect a socio-political element to that strategy. And I think that's very essential. That said, the police is police morale is quite low. I think that's closely related to their salary levels. They serve alongside military forces who are definitely paid better than them and better equipped and have chances of survival that are far higher than theirs. I think there is a great emphasis on placing trainers from the international community within the Afghan National Police. So I think that's already changed, and people have recognized it, and that will be an area where investment will occur. People have challenged us on our survey findings. I might as well just diffuse the next question. That says that the Afghan public generally have hope or faith in the Afghan National Army and Afghan National Police to great levels. We are talking 75% to 85%. And people say, well, how can that be? Because the police is so corrupt and preys on its own people, etc. And I think that's true, but I think we have to remember that the 30 years of war that they went through, a lot of the predatory activities were committed by people who were wearing uniforms for different types of warlords and others. And I think the hope of the Afghan people is that that a military and a police that is in uniform, that is accountable to some formal form of rule of law and justice, is probably a lot better than being subject to various militia that come through terrorizing people. So that's one aspect of it. The second, I think, is simply correlated to their general hope for the future, that at least there's been an end to war and there is some peace, and therefore, the two bodies that are supposed to guarantee some of that are to be looked up to and supported.
Let me open the floor to questions. Let me ask that you identify yourselves, even if I know you, and even if Dr. Verghese knows you, because others in the room may not, and identify yourselves and affiliation.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. I may be reflecting a generational bias, but I tend to look at this through Vietnam, the prism of Vietnam. And how much time do we have? In Vietnam, security was important. We decided we had to train the local army to take over because we couldn't be there forever. We ran out of time. The South Vietnamese were able to turn back the 72 offensive with our air and naval support. They couldn't do it in 75. How much time do we have, given that the Allies are going to pull out? The British are not reinforcing. By the end of next year, I don't know how many of our allies we are going to. And Karen asked, what are our objectives now? In Vietnam, the phrase that people really didn't want to use was decent interval. Is that the objective now, just to have a decent interval?
Am I expected to answer that? I was going to ask some of the people who participate in the new Afghan strategy about these kind of questions.
I think there are two questions here, and one is unfair to ask you, which is how much time does the U.S. government feel it has. I have to say, and I think Bill Nell will bear me out, that in a recent discussion with a number of members of Congress, they all felt the hot breath of time and constituent pressure on me. But the other question is, what kind of time frame is reasonable if one's short-term objective is changing the trend lines so that Afghanistan seems more clearly headed towards a reasonably decent outcome. And the kinds of things that you have spelled out, obviously, in order to succeed in the grand scheme of things are long-term efforts. How long is it likely to take before there are changes that outsiders can perceive more or less with the naked eye?
Well, I think you can only give a sort of commonsensical kind of a response to this simply because, you can be 4 years or 40 years in Afghanistan. It's difficult to actually answer this fully. I like to think of some of this as related to political cycles at least that gives you a frame of reference. And I think that it's important to stay through the next 4 years of the new administration and through the next round of elections at the minimum in terms of full support in Afghanistan, simply because those are the periods of instability that you can predict. And so, I mean, we prepare our program, and when we think about it, we always straddle the periods of instability, simply because you will be pulled back in anyway. Mm-hmm. It's better to plan through them rather than to go out and come back in. So that's one. Second is there are an issue you brought up, the issue of constitutional amendment related to several aspects of nation building, the electoral system, the support, the recognition and legal constitutional support to a different form of, let's say, governance that revolves around subnational entities such as provinces and districts, some issues on delimitation, etc. I think those require, that kind of debate and reform requires a significant period of time. You know, I'm not a legal scholar, but I suspect that would lend itself to a 6 to 10 year period.
You had your hand up.
Thank you very much. I'm Kenneth Katzen with the Congressional Research Service.
Could you speak up a bit?
I'm Kenneth Katzen with the Congressional Research Service. Just a comment to dealing with the broad aggregate of members of Congress. I don't sense a big groundswell to get out of Afghanistan. There are a few members who are expressing concerns, but in the aggregate, there still seems to be very, very strong support for the mission. But the question I wanted to ask is, we don't hear a lot about the provincial councils. They are for election also on August 20th. There's not a lot of reporting on the campaigning, who's campaigning, what their influence is. Do you have any sense about how influential they are, what they really do, what they've accomplished? Not accomplished, as the case may be.
Well, this may not be news to you, but I don't think many of the Afghans know what provincial councils do. They were brought on, I think, prematurely, but for a pretty good reason. That was to stalk the parliament, because members of the provincial council go to parliament, and I think that was probably the main reason. And therefore, there was no follow-up done with them once the elections took place, which was the follow-up related to resourcing them, providing them adequate enabling conditions to relate to the governor, who is plenipotentiary at the provincial level, who is the representative of the president, and does affect every aspect of government and governance at the provincial level. So I think it is a deeply flawed has been a deeply fought exercise. I think governors who are interested in moving things forward have recognized that provincial councils can be obstructionist or could be helpful, and therefore have been entrepreneurial in the way they've co-opted them into the informal ways of governance in provinces, such that the chairman of a provincial council might actually persuade, maybe persuaded by a governor to participate in outreach to tribal communities and other forms of local life there. So I think it has been quite a disappointment. I think donors have tried to bring the focus back to provincial councils from time to time. But the fact is that until very recently, they had no team. They had no ability to actually get line ministries or the governor to be held accountable in any fashion. The only form of, let's say, participation in decision-making was to be in what's called the provincial development planning exercise for the provincial development committee, where, you know, a provincial council chairperson or someone would come and give their views or maybe chair the meeting or something like that. But these are all sort of very symbolic kind of fora.
Do they have any role in the budget?
Not in any regulatory sense. They did participate in the provincial planning exercise that was deployed by the Ministry of Rural Development, But that is simply, a result of good design by the ministry. It had nothing to do with an enabling framework that required them to sign off on allocations.
George, having seen you in action in Afghanistan, Richard from the International Rescue Committee, one of the things I admire about you is I think you are a very, you have very good links into the rising stars in Kabul who are now entering key positions in the Afghan government or will continue to take key positions, and you seem to be a good judge of who's who there. At the same time, here in Washington, people are talking about a civilian surge to send more U.S. American experts to Afghanistan to really provide more expertise and build up government capacities. So where should we be investing? In Afghan nationals or in American experts? And I'll tell you, I've been really arguing against this big surge of Americans, and now I'm thinking about it a little more. I'm thinking, well, maybe we should be doing both. So especially since the American experts may be a drop in the bucket compared to the American military business. But what are your own thoughts about that in terms of investing and sending people?
Well, given that a big chunk of the 3,000 that are going to be sent are going to be co-located with security personnel at PRTs, I think that itself is setting up for potential problems. Something you're familiar with is simply the argument that you cannot mix development and security operations. You put development personnel in danger. So that's one common and prominent argument. But beyond that, some PRTs have been effective, some have not been. The ones that have been effective have stayed on the side of security operations and generally done minor reconstruction and development that, let's say, engineers in the military do really well. When you get into the soft, messy business of governance, I think that it's probably important to think about designing interventions that think about who we are placing there. I suspect a lot of the 3,000 will have neither the experience nor a nuanced view of what it is they will be doing there. I'm familiar with 3 or 4 who are using me as references, and I worry about them. They're ambitious, they want to do things, they're idealistic, etc. I think they would be better received if they were placed in technical ministries where capacity is low. And that could be in line departments, probably more at the central level rather than at the provincial level, simply because below the provincial level, at district level, there is nothing except health and perhaps a few teachers and the district governor. So in secure areas, that's a huge problem, especially if they're American civilians. I mean, your government is preoccupied with protecting these people. So the costs of that, and when you protect them, I mean, you do some serious protection, which makes them inaccessible to Afghans anyway, which is the main problem, is that you have this big blob of people, some of them armed, some not armed, not accessible, doing what we don't know. That's how the Afghans would relate. I think the attitude in Afghanistan is they're going to wait and see. I think they appreciate the attention given by virtue of increasing military personnel as well as by committing civilian Americans to Afghanistan. I think they like that, but they're used to pledges and they're used to people coming and going. I think they're going to wait till the first few actions related to, let's say, civilian casualties, related to Afghan civilian casualties, and related to some of the early experiments in helping in providing technical assistance. I suspect you'll see some successes in the more secure areas, or let's say less conflict affected areas, not more secure, but less conflict affected areas. Simply because you can do more there, and PRTs are not necessarily viewed as locations where kinetic action, sort of kinetic operations take place. But those are not necessarily American PRTs.
I have three people on the list, but I want to follow up on this, the last couple of questions, because I'm really struck, George, by the fact that your answers tend to gravitate to the central government as the key actor.
Yeah, the central Afghan government.
The central Afghan government as the key actor and the key set of institutions that foreigners ought to be supporting. I am going back to the history of Afghanistan as a country where the central government historically was not very strong.
Sure.
Is this because you believe we're at a moment in history where that model has to change, or is it because that's who foreigners are essentially capable of dealing with? And in the latter case, is there something that needs to be done to help build up Afghan capacity at the periphery?
You mean outside of central government?
I mean outside of central government and outside of Kabul.
My reason to go back to central government simply is because the work is not done there. I mean, we began a work there, capacity building in central government, and now suddenly if we start thinking that we can just move everything to the provincial level and not worry about the political problem in the center, which everyone is invested in now for over, several years, I mean, that there's going to be an immense cost to that. So what I've been saying is, in the immediate future, you need to invest in ministries in key sectors, but both at the central level as well as the subnational level. But it can't be across the board simply because it's too expensive. It gets bogged down in all kinds of rivalries. But there are ministers who have demonstrated they're capable of moving money and personnel and training people from top to bottom. MRRD, Ministry of Education, Ministry of Health, is classic, where it's top to bottom. So it's not only Kabul, but it is involved Afghanizing the ministries outside Kabul. I think those kind of ministers and ministries need to be supported. I do not think, and I don't think I will ever think this, that a heavily centralized form of government would work in Afghanistan. This, as I say, is heresy. No circles these days, but I think we'll have to confront that at some point and look at it seriously.
Ambassador Lewis?
Hi, I'm Sam Lewis. I was in Afghanistan, not as ambassador, but as charge, thank you, Camp Daisy, when the king was overthrown in 1973, and had been there for several years. And I have a memory of relations between the central government and the tribal regional leadership, which has been blotted out by more recent events.
Yeah.
But one question that was very relevant then, and I think it is still very relevant, and I'd like to hear your view on it. It's a little bit outside, I guess, your specialty. The question of how much success the central constitution, parliament, government to this point has achieved in building political coalition between the key ethnic leaderships that can last. I see Karzai has been greatly criticized by some for his choice of running mates, which clearly had this in mind, along with other things. But is it, with the Taliban so immersed in the push to the region and the potential for development, as you described, in the near term, probably greater in the north and west, assuming the security situation there doesn't decline much further. Where does this balance between historic Pashtun sense of prerogatives about Afghanistan leadership and the key other competitors for leadership in political terms? Where have we gotten to in 7 years? Where have they gotten to?
Personally speaking, I think the reason President Karzai is likely to be reelected is because of his ability to have kept the country from breaking up in terms of Afghans thinking about their country. That has involved recent and consistent deal-making between him and the folks you mentioned, but not only them, but also the Northerners and the others who have now a stake in a united, unified Afghanistan. I think this is also the root of the insurgency in Afghanistan, the popular Pashtun disaffection and disenchantment with the state-building exercise post-2001. So I think you've hit the nail on the head that unless and until Afghan, and I think they are sufficiently seized, I think until international community recognizes that security operations followed by development and governance, I mean, you know, unless they accept that we have to have some sophisticated discussions on how do we approach the Pashtun issue, I don't think we're going to get very far in terms of political stability. I think Karzai understands this, but in recent years, one worry we've had is there has been, let's say, favoritism showed to some of the tribal alliances, of which he is one representative, as opposed to the others, which again has led to some severe clashes in the south. And this is very evident in Uruzgan, for example, where systematic discrimination against those who are not from that tribal alliance has taken place. This has led to a lot of angst between the majority population and those in power. Both are Pashtun, but one set is favored and one set is not. And this can be something, in terms of fomenting division between Pashtuns, this can be something that can be handled a lot easier than, let's say, the relationship and the discussion about how do Pashtuns figure in the firmament of politics in Afghanistan vis-a-vis the Tajik and the others. I do not think there is a big... I don't think there will be massive worries about, well, you know, a non-Pashtun should be president or anything. I don't think. I think that's accepted that a Pashtun should be president or should be, you know. But it is how you then negotiate the other power-sharing arrangements among the Pashtun, but also Pashtun vis-a-vis the rest. And so far, it's not, in the view of the Pashtun, has favored the Pashtun. Even though most of the positions are held by Pashtun, it's still not enough in the way that they view is their due. And we can argue about it, but I think a discussion must take place, an informed one. You know.
Jerry?
Thank you. Jerry Hannon at CSIS. I'd like to follow up, if I could, on the CRS question and your comment about decentralization. Recently came back from a trip, and unfortunately, we drew straws, and Andrew Weiler got to see you, and I got to see some minister. So,
I told you, that's a feeling to be a rock star.
Hopefully some of the good ministers.
Yeah. I wonder if I could push you a bit on the local... You started your talk by talking about elections at the district level.
And in the lack thereof, yeah.
Pardon?
The lack of elections.
Lack of,
yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. But potentially on what seems to me, to anyway, unsustainable list of elections,
yes,
for the next,
yes,
you know, 94 years,
yeah,
with, I think, one exception.
Yeah.
So that's a first problem. A second, though, is that you then said in the course of your comments, which I was going to ask you about when you talked about the district level, that the provinces themselves have almost no power, that the line ministries control virtually all of the resources down at the provincial level, and yet there's concern about electing sub-provincial councils. And I guess the question is, what are these folks supposed to be doing? The provincial councils don't have any power. The district councils are going to have even less power. You have a plenipotentiary, in theory, plenipotentiary governor, as you suggested, who in some cases have few resources because they're in the line ministries, rather than in the governor's level. So the governor sits on top of a hopelessly unpowerful provincial council, which he or she would like to control, but which don't have any resources to control, and then below that, the district level. I mean, doesn't this sound like a pretty house of cards kind of arrangement to you? We're going to have elections for things that don't have any meaning, don't have any resources, don't have any power, don't move upward, etc., etc. And it seems to me, so that's one sort of question, and the other has to do with decentralization as a general matter in Afghan sort of thought. It's true that the national government hasn't been terribly powerful, although it's had formal authority over a whole variety of areas. And yet, when we asked about decentralization, there was a real fear that the country would break up if you had a lot of decentralized power. And on our team, we had many debates, they still go on, about how much we thought there should be decentralization and and how much the U.S. government and other donors should be engaged in this process, and to what extent it should be it is destabilizing, and to what extent it might be stabilizing, because as the central government tries to enforce a central rule over areas of the country which don't necessarily agree with it, maybe decentralization is a way to keep things together rather than to split things apart. So there's this argument about decentralization simultaneously with a lack of authority and power at these local levels. So it's hard to put all this together with then this, I don't use the word insane, but difficult election cycle that goes on, you know, kind of year after year after year. How do you put all this together in your in CAF's program and in your mind?
These are both very important issues. My conversations this week and the many I've been having since leaving have urged us to really spend a lot of time discussing it, because I doubt that there is a model that it could bring in and deploy in Afghanistan on its own. I mean, we need to spend time on it, the international community and the outcomes, discussing what is possible and what's not. The direction surely lies in giving provinces and districts some ability to raise its own resources and some ability to expend them without too much of a centralized plan of allocation, because they would get bogged down. But given the variation, physiographic variation and heterogeneity of Afghanistan, but you know, I'm not going to give you an answer on that. I'm just saying that there needs to be a real legal discussion on this that is elongated, that needs to take place in Afghanistan in the near future. Now, whether or not that then leads to a discussion about constitutional amendment surely is the next step if they decide to go forward, and that is well... it's a way in the distance, and probably the latter half of the next presidency, if the earliest it would happen, is the earliest it would happen. The electoral calendar is a source of consternation for many, and it is something that must be the subject of discussions for amendment. I don't know if you had time to spend with Zakria Barakzai or any of the others who work at the Election Commission, who have some knowledge of the problems that plague the electoral framework. So, I mean, it's one of the first kind of items for legal reform, for reform in Afghanistan as the election. So, I mean, these are both very pertinent issues you brought up. Let me go back to the matter of provincial councils, governors, and district governors. As I said earlier, the reason to bring in the form of provincial councils had nothing to do with promoting local governance. It had to get some representatives from the local level into parliament. In my view, that was the only reason I was rushed. Of course, those of us who are idealistic thought that, wow, someone really did think about local governance that early on. But it turns out that they didn't. And therefore, sufficient thought wasn't given. And yes, if a similar level of, thinking obtains, then you'll certainly have flawed forms of district-level governance as well. I agree. But why couldn't we spend the next several months talking about what went wrong with the provincial council experiment? Many donors have driven that discussion, but the timing was poor. What I'm saying is the timing might be good following these next elections, simply because you can't go on like this, where you have, you slap together various forms of relating to people. Who do the Afghan electorate relate to at the local level? You know, our survey shows they, for dispute resolution, they go usually to their tribal elders when they should be going to courts or the police, for example. Well, are you strengthening the state by doing that? You're not really. If you're promoting further strengthening of the state. So, I mean, let's recognize the problem for what it is. We've ignored deep discussion and recognition of the problems at the local level with regard to politics and political processes and political structures.
I have three people on the list, the two gentlemen at the end of the room and the lady next to Jerry. You, sir.
Thank you. Jeremy Pam, visiting research scholar, USIP. I think you've just touched on what's potentially a very concrete answer to a central issue that we've been going around, that the last four or five questions have been going around. Ken asked about the provincial councils, and your response was they are teethless. They don't have a formal role in the spending of ministry resources, and they don't have resources of their own. Anne asked, and you said in effect that they don't have a mission, provincial councils don't have a mission. Anne asked about the U.S. civilian surge people and said that she doesn't think that they have a mission. Jerry returned to the subject of what is the mission of provincial council. Is it possible that there's a very straightforward answer to the question of what could be the mission of the provincial councils, which is, as I think, as you just mentioned in passing, to spend resources? Isn't their lack of resources one of the fundamental reasons why they're teethless? And if they were given resources to spend, a degree of fiscal decentralization, not as a zero-sum thing instead of the top-down central government resources, but in addition to, so that there are now competing entities with resource authority at the provincial level, ministry representatives of central ministries and provincial councils, you might have a constructive, competitive dynamic which would take advantage of more capacity and provide incentives for both the national and the subnational capacities to improve. And if you did that, if a decision were made, if a broad strategic decision were made, that's part of the solution, might that not provide part of an answer to what the mission of the U.S. civilian surge could do, which is to help build, to help prepare local authorities, provincial councils, to spend resources, public financial management, knowing that that's a big political decision that has to be discussed at the appropriate national levels, but strongly suspecting that some decision like that may come down the road in the next year and that the groundwork for it needs to be laid now.
I agree. A couple of donors led by DFID have focused a lot on fiscal, some of what you mentioned, and with some success. I think it needs to be broadly replicated. It has been with the blessing of the Ministry of Finance. We think that it has great promise. I think the biggest problem here is political will. The obstruction that I see on the path to empowering provincial councils is the executive that has everything to lose in their mind from empowering a competitor structure to the governor. And this is why I mentioned this as an important aspect of the platform, post-election platform, is that the international community should drive the next government towards examining this candidly and saying that the gap between the people and the government of Afghanistan continues to get bigger simply because you don't pay attention to resourcing the provision of goods and services at the local level through capacity building not only of line ministries and the governor's office and empowering provincial councils, but below that, don't forget, provinces are massive. Some are country-sized. So it's not enough to somehow empower them and place a couple of these young civilians you're going over there in a governor's office or provincial council. Don't forget that some provincial council chiefs are more powerful than the governor, Ahmad Wali Karzai in Kandahar, for example. So I think you have to begin this discussion while thinking within the international community, what will these people do? And I think it's a parallel effort, I agree. We have been quite disappointed by the lack of leadership shown by Parliament in this. Parliament could be a significant player in this. The alliances between national-level elected representatives and provincial council elected representatives could have been far stronger and substance-based than it has been. All they've done is just try to compete with the president and irritate him instead of contributing to some of the things you're talking about, because that could surely work if you've got a parliament united behind a constructive relationship, taking forward experiments that have worked in financial allocation of resources, raising funds, etc. You know, it's not as straightforward as I put it, but you know, there are political complications and deep discussions that need to take place between each of these actors, because a lot of them are very political. A lot of them have a lot to lose, at least in their minds, and they have to be convinced that on the whole there is a net gain to be made.
Yes, sir.
Sure. And my question is about Rick Hill, RTI. But my question has to do with sort of the political sociology of local government, more at the local level, somewhat along the lines of what was implied when Karen talked about the Valhalla Jeffersonian democracy and our design of what we drive in our design of local government. And you mentioned shuras and their role and how that works and how that is the mechanism now used, it seemed, to settle local disputes, and CDCs, which are often just reconstituted shuras, seem to be a mechanism for getting things done at the local level. And yet those are not, they're not chosen through elections and haven't been for centuries. And that sort of choice of the local Afghan about their leadership is not an electoral mechanism. How is all that, when you have elections then, how does that fool with that, and how does that mess with the sense of the legitimacy of a local government?
I have been to some of these shura. The representatives of shura are there because there was an exercise that involved nominating and putting them there. They didn't just show up. In other words, even though someone didn't cast a ballot, there was a process by which they were identified as best able to represent their constituency, whatever that is. So in many ways, they do understand that selecting somebody who can best represent them means something. I'm certainly not a democracy evangelist, but I think from what we've seen in a couple of the provinces where we've helped the government set up alternate forms of political coordination that we call, they're calling them district shura these days, those were not formed through elections either. But when you look at post, the 6 months after formation and discussions with anywhere between 80 and 200 people separately, they were satisfied with the formation of this simply because of the services they provided. It's when they don't provide services or they're under-resourced that people get irritated and start finding fault. So the manifestation of such a body, I think, is far more important in Afghanistan than how it was formed in a way. As I say, they have been able to protect community assets really well in 8 of the 9 districts in Wardha. And I think that resonates very well, regardless of how that shura was formed. I suppose at some point, when they don't start functioning well, then people will find out deep flaws with the way it was formed.
Just to follow up, any comment on the relationship between that mechanism, which seems to work, and the role of people who don't play a role in the choice, such as women?
Well, this has been... We have looked at the National Solidarity Program extensively in 2007 when I led a subnational governance assessment. We like to think of ourselves as constructive critics of the National Solidarity Program. In other words, we feel that the internal rate of return on that program is pretty high compared to other development experiments, certainly not as high as private sector intervention probably are, but then that's too idealistic. What we have found problematic there was, for example, the formation of their CDCs, where they...
CDC?
The Community Development Councils, which is their delivery mechanism at the community level. You know, they've proliferated at an astonishing speed, and I think that's a testament to MRRD's ability to move and the implementing partners they have. The composition of the CDCs can be subject to elite capture, just like in any other country. Where we found CDCs ineffective have been in insecure areas where the local strong man has taken the CDC. Even there, there is a claim that these CDCs are elected and women are represented. Well, it's the wife, the niece, you know, etc. And so, you know, that's the part that we thought was problematic, but probably unavoidable in Afghanistan. In terms of them being broadly representative of the community of interest that they represent, you know, that they are within, located within, so far so good. But let's not, you know, get into then preaching that CDCs and the NSP is a panacea for all problems at the local level in Afghanistan. I think there is that danger as well. I must have digressed there. I think I lost the thread there. But, you know, I get involved in these discussions where people say, well, we don't have local government. Let's just anoint the CDCs as local government. It may be an intermediate solution in the short term, but you may spawn problems that you can't control if you did that. There's not been enough discussion on that.
I'm General Alexander, and I was in Afghanistan for 4 years. Two of those years as a senior governance and elections person, and I had the distinct pleasure of working with George. It's Afghanistan's laws, the polls being. Most of the questions have been asked as sort of the advantage, I guess, at the end, particularly Rick and Jerry covered some of the questions. Quickly for me, two of the ongoing tensions in our work since late 2001 has been this decentralization question. It's plagued us and other donors for years, and we continue to go back and forth with this. The other is about a regional focus. There always is this discussion in U.S. policy and as we think about our programs about whether or not we build on successes and some of the security conditions in central and west and northeast of Afghanistan, or whether we put all of our resources into the south and southeast. That's particularly relevant now that we're looking at the civilian expansion. So my question is, in terms of longer-term governance and state building, do we put our resources into the areas that are showing progress, or do we put our resources into areas that are highly problematic for all kinds of reasons? And then, looking across the other relationship, the other allies who are also doing some terrific both subnational and national governance work, who would you recommend to take a look at their programs? And George knows I asked this for a reason because I'm returning as a governance person in Afghanistan. So to be focused on a couple of those problem areas. So.
You're asking me this so you can go to the more insecure areas, like you did when you were there the first time? Well, you put me on the spot in terms of, well, saying who should they go to learn lessons and all that. You know, it has been a frequent lament of Afghan counterparts and colleagues, especially the governors of the north, that they are being penalized for peaceful provinces. And if you look at resource allocation, you can see that that's true. We have had numerous interactions with excellent ambassadors of, you know, the countries other than the U.S. who have PRTs and other efforts in the south who have allocated quite a sum of money to the south but not to the north. They are classic examples where you could say, well, wouldn't it make sense for your own country's goodwill with the Afghans and for you to demonstrate that you're showing some progress, because progress is difficult to show in insecure areas, but probably insecure, so it's smart portfolio management to put it in both. not to mention design, it's smart design to do so. And their answer was that, well, we simply can't do that. Well, whatever limited resources we have, we are putting it in the insecure areas because that is the agreement and that is where what we think is the core problem emanates from. And the rest goes into national programs, so they're not earmarked necessarily. Something that could be done with regard to resource allocation is the specification of the earmarking with the Afghan government. When you give money to the core budget for, let's say, education or health programs, to specify that you were putting it in. There again, you suffer from loyalties and turf battles, where it is more likely that there is going to be a favoritism shown to certain alliances to get funds. The lessons of the Dutch PRT have been talked about much. They were the first to have social scientists on board when they established their PRT. Their argument is that the more we know about the houses and the locations and communities within which we conduct operations, the better. I have mixed reactions simply because it's not clear to me how much of these operations they actually run. I mean, they pretty much stay in the PRT, I think, unless and until there are specific engagements that they're called upon to support. I think they have different rules than the U.S. I think that's been part of the problem. So statistically speaking, it's possible to claim lower casualties if you just don't leave your PRT. But one of the interesting things they have done is to really have people who understand tribes in Uruzgan. And I think that was critical. Number two is that they have ways of those same people manage aid to NGOs, direct aid to Afghan NGOs in those provinces. So there are any number of, you know, 6 to 21 NGOs, I think, that are supported by the Dutch by themselves. We don't help them manage it. They do it themselves. We have a significant Dutch grant as well to work in Uruzgan. But so they have people who go out and manage. So I would say, you know, Martin De Boer there, who handles, who's the head of aid, when you were there, he was in Uruzgan for 2 years. And now he's the Dutch head of aid in Kabul, and you should talk to him. There may be some lessons to learn from there. But, you know, you can argue that the problem in Uruzgan is significantly less than problems elsewhere where U.S. forces are deployed. Governor Hamdan will claim that as his success, but I think there are many factors.
Well, I think we've got time for just one more question.
Hi, John. Another Kabul regular.
Formerly advisor to the Labor Market Information Analysis Unit at the National Skills Development Program at the Ministry of Labor and Social Affairs. So you were saying earlier that the economic growth is one of the anchors. And you also were saying about dealing with the more effective ministries. Unfortunately, from my experience, some of the ministries that are involved directly with economic growth are some of the more inefficient ministries. Yet I think I really do believe that it is a huge anchor. So how do you deal with that?
You mean pick some of the bad ministries and strengthen them, the ones that have not shown?
Well, I'm just saying that, and I mean, I know how much trouble I went through to get my survey done, and I know what several of the ministries I dealt with to do that were like. And yeah. I know that it was quite difficult, and I'm very pleased that we conducted the first urban labor market survey in the history of the country and finished it. But I know what the ESCs are like, and I know that employment and economic activity is going to be very, and training, they're going to be very hard to promote.
Yeah. I think perhaps we could think of, maybe they should make you in charge of the census, because they still don't have a census done. You've been dragging their feet. You completed a survey with the government. Very good. I think one could adopt a somewhat unconventional, unorthodox approach to thinking about economic growth. As I say, one is just how do you think of the problem? and, you know, try to get away from tying yourself up in saying, well, it's either Iran or Pakistan and that's it, but thinking about innovative ways.
What about its being internal?
Yeah, I was just getting to that.
To me, it's vocational training and agricultural.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we found that actually really upset me, and it's one of the few things that I'm 100% sure of, is that less than 1% of the urban population have been vocationally trained. And compared to when I was in Pakistan doing vocational training in the camps, we had like 5%. Okay. Mm. So that means that it's highly neglected even compared to what it used to be. And it's like nothing, no one's doing anything. I mean, and no one's even paying attention to it.
But why not focus on vocational training as deployed not through the ministries you talk of, but through the sectoral ministries I've been talking about?
Yeah, well, this is. But then you start, you know, that, and also I think
instead of tying ourselves up with the Ministry of Economy, for example, or the Ministry of Commerce.
Right.
I mean, these are, in my view, not to be invested in.
Well, I'm sure we could go on for hours, and. Just thank you very much for being generous with your time and thoughts. And it's been a great pleasure having you here today, and we wish you all success in Nepal, and we'll look forward to the Nepal version.
Thank you very much.